morning. I was asked to give like a historical perspective of our monitoring program, a program that began 10 years ago. And I'm going to touch on the main methodological improvements or switches or research that we have done, and also the direction that our unit is going currently. It has been a great time these 4 past years of dealing with these insects that are concerned for cotton growers. And definitely I have had the fortune to have the backup, the advice of many of you. Probably this is not all the inclusive list, but these 40 cooperators, they have been giving me a really good kind of framework to work with. Still, all the mistakes remain solely for myself. I cannot say that I kind of invented or I adopted all the methodology from nowhere. Before I joined ARS, Dr. Sommerford for 5 years did all the legwork or most of the legwork and took a lot of the heat that I didn't get previously. So I'm going to talk about what happened in the past 4 years that has been my responsibility. First of all, giving you a perspective, tobacco bollworm, even though cotton growers fear it and has been reported to be one of the main cotton pests in the past 20 some years, actually it's a pest that is hard to find. And it's not just my opinion. You just look at the trends of pheromone catches, males that are captured in traps, and has been a really steady decline over the past 15 or so years. And more dramatically, the tobacco bollworm in wild hosts has been reported 25 years, they were like probably 500,000 per hectare, and now 25 years later, you hardly see them. So this is one of the challenges. If tobacco bollworm is really a hard pest to find, a tobacco bollworm resistant to BT should be even harder. But actually, I don't know, because Dr. Wold in 1995 found some tobacco bollworm resistant to BT, but I'm going to allude to that a little bit later. One of the things that we have done and tried for several years is covering all the geographic range of cotton that overlaps with tobacco bollworm. And our initial efforts or efforts year after year were like covering all the territory from east to west, mainly devoted to the eastern part of the cotton belt. And even we tried to go south to Mexico to cover the cotton growing areas. But the results that I'm going to show you really pertain mainly to these geographic locations that have been more reliable year after year. And one of the locations that will have results from this also comes from Arkansas. So it's not highlighted there, but the results also include samples from Arkansas. So from the whole cotton territory, we have done, due to the adoption of BT cotton, as Dr. Reynolds was referring to earlier, we have gone to more specific locations. We also realized that since this is a kind of a hard pest to find, and also BT resistant frequency should not be all that high, we need really high number of samples. And we play a little bit with the idea of having crops that can induce a lot of oviposition. And we adopted in some of the systems garbanzo plots. And also, we are still relying on getting some males from pheromone traps. We know that tobacco bollworm can be caught either on traps or on crops, kind of 66% of the year from April to November. So putting together the good or the reliable geographies and the sampling methods that we are relying on, I think that we have semi-solved the issue of not getting enough samples to do our monitoring. Now, touching a little bit on the methodology, since 2003 we have adopted the F2 screen for tobacco bollworm, and one of the things that we studied was the fact that what I call this kind of a black bucket system, in which in our methodology we put some pupae or moths here inside and some days later we get eggs. And since we were trying to find what was the allele frequency on this, we noticed that feral or field collected tobacco bollworm moths in a situation like this, only 10-15% of them, the females, were feral. So we were losing pretty much 85% of our samples. And more importantly, since we didn't know exactly what happened at any given point, and we really need to estimate how many alleles we were testing, we kind of try to refine this method, because in order to give a report of we tested this many alleles and we have this certainty of being precise or not, this was very key for that. One of the problems with this comes back again to the biology of tobacco bollworm. Depending on the time of the year where you collect these insects, they mate or they do not mate in the laboratory. And doing crosses, pairs, or in mass mating situations, we found again that pretty much 80% of them, they did not copulate. So if we have low copulation percentage and larvae are present on crops for only 1/3 of the year, so we really need to do something about that. Have a lot of larvae to test, or also in our monitoring program include males that have been caught in pheromone traps. With these two methods, we cover pretty much 2/3 of the year, April to November. And because we were all the time very concerned about this kind of methodological bottleneck around August, September, where all the samples came at once and we need to do all the sampling like done right away, we also implemented a method of once that we have an F1 family, put it on diapause, and that will give us some really good time to work a little better with logistics. And for example, right now in the middle of December, we are processing samples of August, and we still have a couple of incubators full of samples to go through. So how are we going to, or how did we increase our mating percentage? Well, one way to do this was having a field-collected moth. Why not mating it with a laboratory rare moth that is already accustomed to our conditions? And we found out that instead of just having 15% success on field moths, doing this cross actually improved to 50%. And I know what you were thinking. You were right away altering your susceptibility to BT toxin. And yes, you are right, we did that. And if you see this is the LC50 of field female and field male, and this is the LC50 of our laboratory colony, and these are the reciprocal crosses between one field and one laboratory moth. Yes, we have altered that a little bit. Actually, it doesn't go beyond 47%, but now we also understand and we know what will be the variation on that. Touching a little bit on what Dr. Reynolds referred to about logistics and prices of doing such a task, of course, keeping a laboratory colony for just this purpose can be an expensive proposition, but pupae samples can be obtained from laboratories. You can purchase them or you can have an agreement with other people. So after dealing with this black bucket system and not yielding the most accurate results that we were expecting, we decided to jump and do the F2 screen of pairs. And this, I don't have to explain you what is an F2 screen, but these are the original parents. And we are going to test the second generation of this by sieve mating or mating within the family, the F1 generation, and the neonates of them will be tested on a diagnostic concentration like Dr. Reynolds was referring to. And in 2007, we also did a serious dilution, so susceptibility of every family that we did. So having this method and going back on what would be the frequency of resistant alleles, I'm going back to what Dr. Wool found 12 years ago. Actually, on a sample of a little bit of more than 1,000 families, he found 3 resistant insects to Cry1AC. Of course, this was major news, and he made a great publication. Probably many of you are familiar with this study, and he was testing only one mode of resistance. Still 3 modes in 1,000, looking for one resistant mechanism. And this is pretty much what we have, but it's a wonderful start because this work was done before the release of BT cotton. So kind of prior, the susceptibility or the frequency prior to the release of BT cotton. And this is what we have currently. This refers to his study 12 years ago. 3 resistant insects in a sample of 1,000. And this is what we have found with a methodology that covers all the possible mechanisms of Cry1AC resistant. And we found none so far on a sample very similar of the one that he got. So this now I can say with some certainty, I can tell you, resistant to Cry1AC in tobacco budworm in 2006 and 2007 has not occurred, and the frequency of resistance is not increasing. Of course, I don't have to tell you that doing pairs, doing families, is a costly and kind of labor-intensive proposition, especially if you are getting one field insect and crossing it with a laboratory insect. That reduces your output in half, but still that will give you a kind of a higher yield of alleles that you have tested. And this was the initial F2 screen on families, very expensive proposition in 2006, very, but in 2007 we have become kind of faster, cheaper, because we let's say 50% of the cost of this screening was to get the samples from the field. That was payment to cooperators, and now we're receiving samples for free, so that cuts on half of that. Our personnel has been cut on half, so that has been a kind of a big increase on that. So what is next for us in ARS? Well, we will continue to do some tobacco budworm screening. And as I'm glad that Dr. Reynolds talked about what will be the situation of secondary pests on cotton, we began work with some of the cooperators in 2007 with fall armyworm. And we are going to be doing the same type of work with fall armyworm families. We already have the initial work, and we will continue doing so. And before I entertain questions, I really would like to thank Dr. Matten for all her patience, leadership, and advice for all of us in Stoneville, and probably for most of us here in the audience. And I thank you for your attention.
Dr. Blanco is quite funny. I did not drink all those bottles that you saw in front. We went to Mexico on as part of a BT monitoring discussion, both from the applied and basic standpoint. And I must say our Mexican hosts are far better than any American hosts we've ever had, and it was amazing amounts of liquid refreshment, I'll put it that way. So if you have any questions for Carlos, please feel free to ask them. I feel like I should do a Bob Barker thing. Come on down. No, go ahead, Dave. Speak up.
The question was, how did I calculate the cost of it? Yes, salaries turn out to be after the payment for getting the samples from cooperators turn out to be the other major factor. These salaries include the technician that I have and three laboratory assistants. I don't have a technician now, and I only have two laboratory assistants, so that's why the costs have come substantially low. Yes. The question is that for fall army worm, we don't have any susceptibility data, and how am I going to calculate the diagnostic concentration after that? Sako, I think that I'm going to rely on you and many of you after I get the initial results of the susceptibility bioassays. After that, probably I'll pick up your brain on how to are we going to calculate a diagnostic concentration? Yes. Thank you very much.